Don't you think it's time you live the best life possible? Buckle on up as you are about to learn how to develop meaning and purpose in life from a decorated performance coach who just happens to be the son of Tony Robbins.
Welcome to the Motivation Show podcast and get ready to be inspired, motivated, and achieve massive success. And now, your host, the mayor of motivation, Eli Marcus.
Our guest is a decorated human performance coach and speaker to world-class companies and organizations. He is the best-selling author of Live It, which received rave reviews from none other than Deepak Chopra, Brian Tracy, and other self-improvement titans. The practical tools he shares in Live It can help anyone add deep meaning and purpose to their life while achieving massive success, my favorite topic. His philosophy is learn it, live it, give it. Learn what it takes to be successful. Live it fully in your own life, then give it to others to help them do the same. Wow, now that is powerful, and we are going to dive right into this life-changing mantra. Welcome to the Motivation Show, Jerick Robbins.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Jerick, I am excited and I'm pumped up because we are going to be talking about, I think, both of our favorite topics, which is how to make a difference in other people's lives and how to help them move things forward. And I want to start out with a fascinating story that you talk about in your book, where you say you had malaria that you got in a Ugandan village of all places, and you were told that you only had 5 days to live. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Sure. So I was teaching organic farming locally in the villages to help revive the land that had been poisoned by some corporations that sold them illegal pesticides and killed off all their plantations and farming. And while I was there, I happened to catch malaria. I grew up in Southern California, where we heal everything through, you know, vegetable juice and meditation. So when I got malaria, I was like, I'll be fine. I'll just, you know, work my way through it, let my body process it. And I remember I waited way too long. I got to the point where I had like 65,000 parasites per one red blood cell. And I finally went to see the doctor, and he took my blood and showed me the fact that I had 65,000 parasites per blood cell. And he's like, hey, you have to take the medication immediately. I was like, I don't do that. And he was like, wow, okay. So he went and did some math and showed me the numbers and how it doubles every 8 to 10 hours. And that's when he told me I have about 5-6 days left to live. And I remember that feeling where it caused me to really kind of like that in a movie where you see the life flash before your eyes and you see all the things you've done, but then have all the dreams you still haven't done yet. And I remember just thinking of like, wow, this is nowhere close to what I really want to do. Like, I haven't even scratched the surface of life yet. There's so many things I want to experience. What it did help me do though is narrow down what was most important, because the things that flashed before my eyes of like, I never got to fall in love and get married. I never had a chance to have a family. I never had a chance to start a business or try to make a lasting difference in the world, you know, create something that would outlast my actual physical life, but continue to help people way beyond me. I never had a chance to, you know, tell the people how much I loved them, who really mattered to me. Never. And the list that it made became the most important focus of this next period of my life. But it was a wake-up call. It was that experience where it caused me to deeply question everything that had gone on in my life. I remember I read a book and it talked about this concept that the first mountain we climb in life is what we can get from life. And the second mountain we discover in life is what we can give to life. And even though I was there volunteering and giving back and helping, there was still a deep part of me at that stage of my life, 18, 19 years old, where I was focused on what I could get from life, what I wanted to achieve, my bucket list, what I wanted to experience, what I wanted to have and do and create. But all these things were mainly because of how it made me feel as a human being, made me feel important, made me feel significant, made me feel powerful, made me feel confident, all these things. And I remember after that experience, the only things that really mattered to me were the things I could give to life. I wanted to find someone I could fall in love with and share life with them, help experience magic moments together, help turn their dreams into reality. I remember I wanted to have a family so that I could provide the same or better childhood that I had growing up to my future child. I remember wanting to make something that would outlast me, to know that my life mattered more than just to me, but it mattered to the community and actually made people's lives better in some way beyond my physical presence. Like, something started to click in that moment where it became more than just about the things I wanted. It became more about the things I hoped I was able to give and or share.
That's pretty remarkable. You were age, I think, 23, right, Jarek? 18
so
at the time?
That was like 18. So 18 was a trip around the world. 19, 20, I was probably 20, right in that time zone. Coming back, got healthy, got things together. That would probably lean into 21, 22. Somewhere around 23 was when I finally started to go out on my own business-wise and started to put stuff together, where I moved out on my own and started my own business and tried to figure out a way to bring it to life. And then 24 is when it kind of caught traction.
You know, we've all heard the idea that we need to give back, but most of us struggle in really either believing it or doing it. And part of it you actually touch upon in your book, which is that, you know, most people are so consumed with trying to hit their own personal goals that helping others, you know, just going to get pushed to the back burner, you know. And we are thinking, like, how do we get our share? How do we get the bigger house? You know, how do we keep up with the Joneses? So how do people, even at an early age like yourself, come to that realization without focusing on their own personal goals?
It's interesting. When I was young, I had kind of both experiences, where my mom and I lived in a very simple, you know, little one or two bedroom apartment, depending on what time period it was in. My dad worked really hard to provide for us. And my mom also worked side jobs and weekend jobs to make sure we had enough money for like food and fun stuff and stuff like that. But through that process, I got to see then how my dad was working so hard to create this wildly abundant life, like helicopters and limos and a castle he lived in and all this stuff. And so I got to see and experience moments of this insane level of abundance and then live my day-to-day life in, you know, an apartment with my mom and like work on swap meets on the weekends to earn some extra money kind of stuff. And so by going back and forth between these, what was really interesting is having kind of a holistic experience of seeing like, wow, this is what's possible. And this is normal. This is what normal feels like to me. And the dance and or the lessons that came from both sides started to create a blueprint. You know, I could call it a success strategy or a success blueprint, but things where I started to pay attention to what are the things that are really working and what are the things that aren't working. And so I started to pay attention to the people closest to me. And that's what most of us do growing up, where we look at the humans directly in front of us or around us. So our mom, our dad, our friends, our family, our community, the people right next to us is what we tend to pay attention to the most. Nowadays with social media, we look at the world. But back then, we just look closely at our peer groups and surroundings. And I started to watch and look for what the difference of the things that were working versus things that weren't. My mom was continuously struggling with her health. And I was like, ah, I'm not going to repeat the same thing she's doing because that's not working. But my mom was wildly abundant in how much she cared about people. And she never had a lot, but she always found a way to help other people. And so I remember watching, and just to give you perspective, like she was the person who'd have three maxed out credit cards, but earn enough money to pay down $500 on one credit card and say, oh, I've got $500 to spend. And I was like, Mom, no, you don't. You're wildly in debt on all the cards. Like, you don't have an extra $500. Like, you're still down thousands and thousands of dollars in credit card debt. But it's not how she saw it. She saw it and said, okay, I have $500. And I remember we would drive down the street and she'd see a homeless person and then figure out how to get some money off the card onto some type of like food gift card and give it to the homeless person.
Wow.
And I'd watch her. I'm like, she had nothing, but would always find a way to help other people. And I was like, that is awesome. Like someone who cares regardless of the situation they're in. Moving forward, I remember growing up around my grandma, where my grandma raised five kids, including my mom. And then, you know, after raising kids, went to work, and she was a secretary at a chamber of commerce because that's kind of what women did back then. But then as the women's movement evolved and women can now do anything, she got into sales. And then she became the number one sales reps in dozens of companies she worked for. Like every company, she was the number one person. She was on the cover of Newsweek magazine, got the key to the city of Los Angeles, was businesswoman of the year. Like she really, really crushed it in all these different categories. And with her, I remember figuring out like what works, what's the magic there? And she grew up at a time in Los Angeles where there was definitely, you know, a white and brown or colored divide. That existed. My great grandpa, he had a tailor shop. He had a coffee shop. He had these little businesses and he earned, you know, some money and saved it up. I remember she told me a story where he bought a rental property on the white part of town. And they told him he couldn't, and he was a rebel. He disregarded. And the day after he bought it, they burned it to the ground. I was like, oh geez. And then she told me a story where she went to the only swimming pool in town as a kid. And they let the colored kids swim first. And then afterwards they drained the pool and then bleached the pool before they let the white kids swim. And I was like, oh, wow. And so she didn't grow up in an environment that was abundant and everyone working together like we have today. She grew up in a place where it was a little rough. And I remember asking her, I'm like, what's your philosophy? Because you've done so much, even though it started out in kind of a rough place. And I'll never forget. She said, my philosophy is take the cards you're dealt and play them to win the game.
We like that.
I was like, I love that.
Yeah.
She took what life handed her and said, hey, I don't know if there's good, bad, right, wrong, or indifferent. It doesn't matter. I'm going to figure out how to win with what I have. And she did multiple times over and over again.
That's a great lesson because so many people are sort of finding the easy way out and to explain why they haven't achieved or done the things in life that they were meant to do by just saying, well, you know, look at the circumstances I grew up with, you know, look at who my parents were, you know, finding a million reasons. But like you said, take the deck that you've been dealt with and work with it right there. You know, you can do anything with anywhere that you are. You can build from so many examples in history of people who have been down and out in their luck and they just achieve such great things. In fact, their stories are some of the most motivating stories in the world, you know, when you've actually had nothing and you rose up from that. Now, in your book, you talk about fighting an uphill battle with your friends. I find that very interesting. You're trying to convince them to focus on giving back to others and easing up on their quest for that success. And you kind of gave up on it. You were struggling to get that done. You trying to find a different way. Why can't we have both? Sure. Why shouldn't we do both?
So my thought is, if you're one of those people that wants to drag a stubborn donkey up a mountain that doesn't want to go, I mean, you're welcome to do it. I'm not going to stop you or tell you it's a bad idea. I'm just telling you it takes a heck of a lot longer than finding a racehorse that is galloping towards the peak. Ooh, and nice. You run with it. Totally different experience in life. Some people like the stubborn ones where it's like, oh, I'll get them. And that they just find meaning and purpose in their own life of trying to convince that stubborn one to go. And what I found out was, I had kind of found that second mountain moment in my life, but they hadn't yet. And I judged them for still being so consumed with their first mountain, saw the stuff they wanted and the cars and the travel and the even the house or like whatever it was, like the stuff they thought they needed to achieve before they were successful. And I would judge them based on that. And at some point I remember just realizing, I'm like, why am I judging these people? There's nothing wrong with what they're doing. And then I said, wait a second, why am I not? They're my friends. Why am I not helping them? And then my brain was like, because that stuff doesn't matter. That's not important. And I was like, well, it's important to them and I care about them. Therefore, it should be important to me. And I was like, it's not. I don't care about that stuff. I was like, I know, but they do. And life isn't just about me. So if they care about it, I had an epiphany. I said, what if I help them get those things faster? What if my mission became helping them scale the first mountain as fast as humanly possible? And then stepping back when they're there and seeing if a little window of opportunity opens where they might look for something more. I built a whole business around this. How can I accelerate people's experience of getting what they want, hoping that once they get what they want, they'll feel abundant, they'll look around and want to either A, find something with more purpose and meaning in it, or B, just help others conquer that same mountain over and over again. And it's worked.
I love that formula. And speaking of formulas, you do have the formula that I mentioned in your intro, where we start with learn it, learner, that you learn all that you need to design your ideal life, the vision for your life. So how do people actually go about this?
Sure. So there's three parts of that. It's learn it, live it, give it. And when it comes down to your vision, there's new material that the book was written years ago, but there's new material since then I've thought up. And this concept of having a vision might come down to, what are you most curious about? What are you most interested in? What are you fascinated with? I'll give you a phrase. What would you want to have a personal PhD level of understanding in your life? And with this concept, I took a trip, and it was a student trip where I got paired up with a roommate. And when you meet a roommate and you're in university, it's usually like, hey, my name is Jarek. I study psychology. Like, what's your major? That kind of stuff. And I remember I met this guy, my roommate's name was Bradley, and he was so proud. He's like, hey, my name's Bradley. My major is love. I was like, you're majoring in love? One, I didn't know that was an option. Two, how is that an option? Like, my brain exploded because I'd never heard that before. Like, I heard psychology and economics and business and marketing and all this stuff, but I never heard love. And I was like, it sounds cool. And he's like, well, I go to Cal State Berkeley. And I was like, that explains a lot. And I said, and how do you major in love? And he says, well, it's not technically a love major. What it is a choose your own major. And then I was able to sit with an advisor, craft the entire curriculum. So the books we'd read, the classes we take, the people we'd studied with, all the things that we'd really get a deep level of understanding with. And then we would title that liberal arts major as a major in love. So a bachelor in arts emphasis major in love. And I went, wow, that's cool. That's really cool. And so I took that concept and I said, what would I want to have a PhD level of understanding in? If I could have a PhD in any topic in the world, what would I want a PhD in? And I was a little jealous of Bradley. So I said, I would want a PhD in relationships. I think that's important, who you spend time with and the depth and connection you have with those humans. I said, I want a PhD level understanding of business. That'd be cool. Business and money, like those would be cool topics to dive into. I love a PhD level understanding in health, fitness, performance of the mind, body, and emotions. That would be very cool. And so I looked at that and I've spent the last, 9 years studying business and really perfecting it. I mean, we learned all the tools, then we applied them to our own business. And I remember in the first three years we applied the tools into our business, we had 143% growth overall. We were making more profit in a month than we used to make in a year. Like it worked extremely well in implementation, what we had learned. And then the third step is to share it with others, to give it. So then I found other people with small businesses that I could help. And we took one business during the pandemic. They got 50% growth in revenue that year. They had 179% growth in profitability and 195% growth in net profit, all within 12 months during the pandemic. And so I was like, oh, shoot, I could do that for them. And then I started to do it for others and it worked. And I was like, okay, I've learned the tools. I've lived it in my own life and gotten the results myself. And we've been able to give it with 3 to 5 other companies and get the same or better results with each one of them. I got this. Same thing in relationships. I spent the last 15 years studying relationships, 5 years before I met my wife, preparing for a relationship. Because I thought about it, I'm like, well, if you were going to go to the Olympics, you'd practice every day and prepare for the Olympics. If you were going to do a spelling bee, you'd practice every day and prepare for a spelling bee. And I was like, what do we do to prepare for a relationship with somebody? Most of us just show up and think it's supposed to work. And I was like, that's stupid. I'm like, that's a stupid approach. I was like, I should probably study, practice, and prepare before I meet the person so that I'm actually competent and ready for the relationship itself. So I spent 5 years studying relationships before I met my wife, and we've spent the last 10 years practicing together.
So is there any secret besides yes, dear?
Totally. The people who say yes, dear are generally older men. As men age, their testosterone starts to fall. And as women age, they go through menopause and then their testosterone actually goes up. That way, when you hear older couples and they always say the secret to making this last is just saying yes, dear. And she goes, that's right. She's generally more driven, focused, and assertive at an older age. And he's generally more docile and less aggressive at an older age, purely based on the biological shifts. And so once you understand the biological shifts, some people like how that feels. Therefore, it's natural and normal. Other people don't. So they start doing hormone rebalancing or treatments to get it back to how it used to be kind of stuff. But there's really, really amazing research. If you go to Gottman.com, they have over 35 years of research on over 3,000 couples of every type, pairing, situation you could imagine. And they've narrowed it down to 7 specific things that make relationships last, period. Scientifically proven, 35 years of research. Here is exactly the 7 things. When you do these, or these things are present, the relationship works. When any of these 7 are not present, the relationship decays and eventually falls apart. So it's really neat to see people do that level of research over significant periods of time to break it down to habitual behaviors, habits, and ways in which you go about it that actually make it work.
Well, isn't it fascinating, Jarek? There's literally a formula for everything, including, you know, how to make a relationship work. And if people just work that formula, you know, life would be just so much better. And, you know, the reason I love your book, you know, it has a formula. It's got like 12 different chapters in there with a formula, you know, and the title is great. And I like the subtitle because it's Live It, Achieve Success by Living with Purpose. And you talk about, you start off, you're talking about designing your ideal vision for your life. Then you do a little bit of a pivot because you say it's too big of a bite to chew and it's overwhelming when you look at your entire life. You know, that's going to stop people in their tracks right there. So tell us about that first chapter. You start with designing your ideal day. So you kind of break it down into just 24 hours.
Totally. So the concept there is, for most people, especially if you're in a transition in life, if I were to say, tell me what 10 years from now looks like in every part of your life, how's your health? How's your relationship? How's your business? How's your finances? How's your family? Most people are like, whoa, I don't know, dude. I'm just trying to figure out what I want to do tomorrow. Like, I'm trying to figure out what I want to eat for lunch. I don't know what 10 years looks like. So I've had that experience and discussion with people or clients I'm working with. And I went, ooh, that's too much. How do I get this to a thing where they're like, ooh, that's interesting. I'm excited to figure that out. And trying to make the next 10 years become true is a long time for most people. I mean, most people, 7 seconds, if the screen didn't load fast enough, they already shut the website and moved on. 10 years, are you kidding me? That's so long for most people. So I said, well, what if you just focused on a day, just one day? If you had one perfect day, that's the only one you ever get in your whole life, but you had one perfect day, what would it be like? And we help people dream this up and imagine it. And I've helped people who are just getting started and students. You know, we worked with a group of students in Houston that Oprah had funded this school. We had them all create their ideal days. And then I've worked with, you know, executives at Goldman Sachs who wanted to transition out of banking and get into their own private business. And I helped them design their ideal day. So it works for everybody. Military people, special operators in the Air Force, like all these people. I said, what is your perfect day? Just one day. And so we dream up this day. And then we say, okay, what could we do moving forward so that each day we can move one step closer to that day being a reality? That's it. Just 1 ounce of progress each day, just 15 feet in the right direction. And what happens is, for me, it took 18 months from the day I wrote the vision to the day I actually lived it moment by moment the entire day. And that was my literal life from that page to reality. Took me 18 months. For other people, I've had people write this out, look at it and go, my daily life right now is not that far off. I'm pretty much like living it. Like, this is my life. Few adjustments, but most of it's real. I've had other people tell me, I mean, that's my dream, man, but I'm nowhere close to that. Like, how in the world am I going to do even one day of this? And so everyone starts in a different position, but the goal is, can I just move 15 feet closer each day?
I love that, handle it in small chunks. Anybody can plan that one 24-hour. Planning a whole life can drive you crazy. So I love how that works. You know, there are some people, Jarek, that, and I'm sure they've come to you, they've come to me, they said, you know, Eli, I was so pumped up last week. I heard your lecture, you know, I heard your podcast. I was ready to light the world on fire. And, you know, I'm just like, back to my old tricks again today. How do you speak to someone like that who gets pumped up, you know, stops, gets pumped up again, stops, and doesn't have that so-called immersion into, like your father talks about all the time, immersion?
Sure. So people who have that pattern have to realize it's just a habit. They have a habit of quitting. They have a habit of falling off track. They have a habit of not following through. That's okay. You just need a new habit. There's tons of books. James Clear wrote a great book, Atomic Habits. It literally tells you the exact formula of how to create a new habit and then how to build the new habit into your life. And all of a sudden you're wildly consistent. Like, none of that's hard nowadays. It's funny when people tell excuses of like, oh, I have the ADHD something, whatever, and I can't do that. And I'm like, no, you have a habit of telling everyone that story. Like, you told me every time you saw me, that's a habit. So you have plenty of habits. You just got to pick slightly different habits. One of my favorite things is he discusses, you never stop a habit. You only replace a habit. So it's not about stopping it or getting yourself to never do it again. It's like, no. You're going to do something like it. We just have to get you to do something a little better than what the old habit was. So again, it's just about micro progress. It doesn't have to be life-changing overnight. It just has to be, hey, I used to eat the worst thing. Now I eat something a little healthier, now a little healthier, now a little healthier. And eventually you're eating stuff super healthy and it never touched the old stuff. But it was about just choosing a healthier option each time, little by little.
Jarek, tell me your thoughts about the person who's sort of okay in their life. You know, they got a decent job, they're getting a pension, they're going along well, but they're not quite passionate as you are about what you're doing for a living. Obviously, there's a level of fear, and there's probably a level of, what am I getting myself into? Am I going to be working 7 days a week? How am I going to figure this all out? What are your thoughts?
Sure. If that works for them, do it.
Yeah. Well, what if it doesn't work for them? What if they're just don't know how to make the change? What if they're just stuck in that thinking? Maybe they're just playing it safe. They don't know how to take that risk, or they see it as too much of a risk.
Yeah. So I look at this in two ways. My friend Gary says, if you're making 40 grand a year, but you are happy as can be, and you wake up at some weird hour, go to work, come, you know, you're pretty happy, but you know, you like your work. You don't love it. It's pretty good. You come home, you play video games with your kids, and you really love your life. You're doing way better than someone making 500 grand a year who wakes up, grinds all day, forces them to do stuff they absolutely hate just to make more money. And so he's a big fan of like, hey, choose the life version that makes you really, really happy and alive and makes you feel joyful and joyous every day. Like, if you find that version of your life, regardless of what it is, do it. It's worth it. And if people are hesitant towards doing it, there's lots of ways to do it. Every person's going to use a different strategy. My dad has a strategy where he's like, cut the boats and burn the boats and take the island, like go all in, make it a must. I'm like, that shit's crazy. No, thanks. The way I did it was work three jobs. I was like, hey, I know what I want to do. I know my reality. So I'm going to work three jobs to cover the bills. And then in my spare time, when I'm not working the three jobs, I'm going to start a business of my own. And I'm going to keep working on my business until my business makes enough money to take away one job. And I have two jobs in a business. And then make enough money to I could take away the second job. And then make enough money to I could take away the third job. Now I'm making just as much money in my own business as I used to make in three jobs. But now I just have to focus on my main business and keep going. And so I didn't burn the boats and take the island kind of stuff. I just worked three jobs and kept building my little business until it one by one took over the money I needed and then kept going.
So in closing, Jarek, and we can talk all day long, but I know you got to go. There's something that's in your back book cover there, jacket, and it says every person you meet is either a warning or an example. Tell us what you mean by that.
Sure. So at that stage of my life, when I wrote it, I was wildly judgmental on people. And since then, I've learned every person you meet is both a warning and an example. And what I've learned is if you hang out with someone long enough, people say never meet your heroes because you'll find out maybe they're not as great as you thought. Here's the truth, though. Yep. If you hang out with them long enough, you will find in some part of their life where they are a huge warning of what not to do. If you hang out with them long enough, you'll find it. And no matter how rough someone's life is or how much you judge them, if you hang out with anyone long enough, you'll probably find at least one thing they do that would be a beautiful example of what to do in life. And so I believe everyone you meet is both a warning and an example. Based on your goals, based on your dreams, based on what you're wanting to accomplish, you have to then use that filter and say, hey, if that's where I'm trying to go, is this person me teaching me what to do? or is this person showing me examples of what not to do? And if we're able to pay attention to the world around us, we'll quickly pick up examples of what to do and clearly pick up examples of what not to do. And if we can learn from each person we cross paths with, we'll create a path towards where we ultimately want to go.
Beautifully said. So, Jarek, I'd like to learn more about places that you're speaking, things that you're doing, and I'm sure others would like to, and some other people here might want to have you as a coach. Tell us about how they can find you.
Sure. So I'm currently the president and chief strategy officer of Success Enterprises. So success.com, Success Magazine, you can go there and find me. We have Success Speakers Bureaus. We have Success Adventures coming up later this year. We do once in a lifetime bucket list activities with entrepreneurs and business owners traveling around the world with like-minded people. We have Success Coaching if you're looking for a coach. Also, if you want to just reach out to me personally, you can go to jarekrobbins.com, which is my main site.
Our guest today has been Jarek Robbins, and I encourage everybody to go out there and buy the book, Live It, because I'm going to read it a second time, because one nugget of those 12, and if you could pick up all 12, you're really ahead of the game. Thanks for being our guest today, Jarek.
Thank you for having me.
If you would like to inquire about having Eli motivate your team, speak at your event, or coach you personally for massive success, email themotivationshow@gmail.com. That's themotivationshow@gmail.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.